Okay, I won't even ask what that is. It's good to be here. Thanks for coming. I know it's toward the end of the semester, and more importantly, it's very cold outside. So Lynn is not here. She's giving an in-service in the Metro Public Schools, actually, with Kim Paulson. Let's see. How do I work this thing?
Spacebar.
Sorry? Okay. Great. Thank you. So, what I want to do is I want to share with you. I know that you represent all the five academic departments in the college. And so, in thinking, when Tim asked me, Lynn and me both, to do this, I tried to think of something that I could talk with you about that might be of interest to many of you. I won't presume that all of you will find this interesting, but many of you, hopefully. And it just so happens that we have just finished the third year of a three-year study on peer-assisted learning strategies. And so what I would like to do is just sort of jump in, and I'm going to spend the first part of this of my time before I turn it over to you guys, and hopefully you'll have some good questions and comments and so forth. What I'd like to do in the first part is first to tell you about PALS. You need to know something about PALS because I'm using it really as a vehicle to explore something related but different. And hopefully this thing that I will be describing to you that we have spent 3 years exploring will be of interest. So this is looking at what we're calling bottom-up versus top-down approaches to scaling up PALS, which stands for peer-assisted learning strategies, and you see all of the various folks who have contributed mightily on this project. So the purpose of PALS is to supplement the core curriculum, the universal curriculum. It's a supplemental program in reading and math, typically implemented three times a week for reading, twice a week for math. In principle, it creates a kind of routine or organizational structure within which teachers can move closer to differentiating instruction for groups and individuals, groups of students and individuals. Differentiated instruction, you know, is one of the buzzwords of the past 5 or 10 years. For any of you who have been teachers and have really tried to differentiate your instruction, you know how difficult it is, even if you're smart, motivated, and have resources. So we, over the past 15 years, have developed PALS reading at kindergarten, first grade, grades 2 through 6, and high school, and in math, kindergarten, first grade, and grades 2 through 6. Okay, so, I mean, we do other things too, but we have spent a tremendous amount of time and effort developing programs that we want to be effective, promoting academic competence among all kids, but especially kids on the lower end of the achievement continuum, low-achieving, non-disabled kids, as well as kids with disabilities in mainstream classrooms. Our work was originally based on researchers' efforts at a place called Juniper Gardens Children's Project in Kansas City, Kansas. And as I said, 15 years of experimental work in Title I and non-Title I schools, urban and suburban schools. Our focus has always been on high, average, and low-achieving kids, even though our real interest is low-achieving kids. And the reason for our interest in high and average and low achieving is because we, as former teachers, we know that if we're going to develop a program and try to sell it, if you will, to teachers, try to get teacher buy-in, and tell them that it's only good for the four lowest kids in their class, we stand a snowball's chance in hell of that teacher adopting the program, right? Similarly, if we came and said, this is only, we only have data supporting supporting the proposition that the program will work for the top four kids in your class, we get the same reaction. So in our research, what we have tried to do, and it has been clearly an iterative process with many failures and dead ends, we have tried to come up with programs that work for all, you know, for all groups of kids, not for every kid. There is no program that works for any kid, for every kid, as you well, as some of you know. There's no silver bullet solution for all kids, but for the vast majority of kids, that's what we were aiming for. And so, our PALS work in reading and math over the years has been recognized as a validated practice by the What Works Clearinghouse, U.S. Department of Education, and Johns Hopkins Best Evidence Encyclopedia B, which, by the way, is a very interesting clearinghouse developed by Bob Slavin out of profound frustration over the What Works Clearinghouse failures over the years. I don't know if you guys have followed that, and Tim, I don't know how much you know about that, but What Works Clearinghouse has spent probably $100 million of your and my dollars, and until recently had very little to show for it. And Bob Slavin, as another program developer, was tearing his hair out because he could not believe how little help the What Works Clearinghouse really was to practitioners. It was established about 10 years ago. The aim was to be the means of bridging research and practice, getting researchers, you know, stuff in comprehensible form so that principals and superintendents and boards of education and teachers, you know, could go to and learn about what they might be doing in their classrooms. So I want to talk with you a little bit about grades 2 through 6. PALS reading in grades 2 through 6. There are three, you know, after all this work, we came down to three major activities that constitute PALS for the elementary grades. Partner reading, the purpose of which is to get kids to do a lot of reading out loud. Paragraph shrinking, which is a comprehension activity, trying to get kids to become skillful at formulating main ideas. And prediction relay, which is meant to also further comprehension by encouraging kids, reminding kids how important it is when they read to be active readers, to be involved in the text. A good reader, almost by definition, is someone who is engaged, who is asking questions, who is asking of him or herself, am I understanding what I'm reading? Well, that's interesting. I wonder how she's feeling. I wonder what's going to happen next, and so forth. So these activities were chosen by a review of the research literature, trying to take what is most potentially effective, while keeping in mind the crucible in which this is going to have to work. So we came up with many great ideas, many clever ideas, which we threw out, or teachers with whom we were working threw out when they proved impractical. So a little bit more about these three activities. Again, I'm doing this because I want to just give you a sense of what PALS reading at the elementary level is so I can move on from there. Partner reading is conducted for about 11 or 12 minutes each time, each PALS session. The stronger reader reads aloud for 5 minutes. The weaker reader then reads the same text aloud for 5 minutes. And the weaker reader, after she or he finishes, retells the story for a couple of minutes. The readers are encouraged to read quickly, correctly, and with expression, and the coaches are to listen and to correct mistakes when they hear them. And they are trained by their teacher, who in turn was trained by us, to identify the mistakes and help the reader quickly and efficiently so the reader could then move on. There's a point system, which I'm not going to go into, which is motivation for many kids. Paragraph shrinking, as I said, is a comprehension activity conducted for 10 minutes each session. For 5 minutes, the stronger reader reads aloud and summarizing the text paragraph by paragraph. The summarization includes the naming of the most important who or what and the most important thing that happened to the who or what. The statement of the main idea must be in 10 words or less. We came to 10 words or less after we were listening to kids summarize a 75-word paragraph in 250 words. Prediction relay, as I said, another comprehension activity. Kids are to make a prediction before they do any reading, then make a prediction as to what's going to happen, read half a page, check to see if the prediction is true, state a main idea, make a new prediction, and continue to read. The stronger reader goes first, and then the weaker reader goes next. You hear me saying stronger reader, weaker reader. We ask teachers at the start to rank order all of their kids from 1 to whatever, 26, 28, and in terms of strongest reader, weakest reader, divide that rank ordering in half, and then combine the strongest kid in the first half with the strongest kid in the bottom half, the next strongest kid in the top half with the next strongest kid in the bottom half, and so forth. And that's how the initial pairings of kids takes place. This is a peer-mediated activity. Kids are trained to work collaboratively, supportively, productively with each other. They're told repeatedly that if they do that, both of them will become stronger readers. The weaker reader knows who the stronger reader is, the stronger reader knows who the weaker reader is, but because the roles are reciprocal, that understanding mitigates any possible poor feelings on the part of the weaker reader in most cases. Over the years, we've conducted two kinds of PALS research. We've conducted what's called randomized control trials. This is the so-called gold standard of educational research. And so our schools, which were oftentimes in our studies deliberately divided into Title I schools, high poverty Title I schools, and non-Title I schools. And within those schools, classrooms would be randomly assigned to a PALS condition and a non-PALS or controls condition. So we were controlling for possible school effects. We collected data on high achieving, average achieving, and low achieving children. We also took pains to collect what we call fidelity of treatment implementation data. So it wasn't enough for us just to ask teachers to and kids to implement the program. We figured out how to collect data on whether and to what and with what degree of accuracy they were implementing the program. And all children in the study, in all of these schools, in all of the classrooms, were tested prior to treatment or prior to the study, and immediately following the study on an individual basis. So here is a here's a typical result of a later stage study. As I said before, some of our early studies come out terribly. In part because we didn't know what we were doing. But in a later stage study, what we were looking for is we have learning disabled kids, low achieving, non-disabled kids, average, and high achieving kids identified by their teachers. These numbers represent the improvement in words read correctly in 1 minute. So this is a fluency, reading fluency. These are reading fluency data. We have other kinds of data like comprehension data. This is reading fluency data. So so if we look at this yellow bar, this is the kids with learning disabilities across classrooms that were involved in PALS reading, So this was the PALS Learning Disabled Group, and you see that over a 16-week period as a group, they increased their performance by 50 words per minute, as opposed to learning disabled kids in non-PALS or control classrooms who improved their fluency by about 30 words a minute. And so you can look at low-achieving kids in PALS classrooms and non-PALS classrooms, average-achieving kids in PALS, no PALS, and high-achieving. And this was what we were kind of looking for, this kind of pattern, before we felt confident that we had a program that was effective. It had to be effective for all groups of kids. Again, not every kid, but all groups of kids. Okay, you with me? Any questions? If you have some question as to, you know, to help you understand better, you know, you should let me know.
Who did the assessment?
Sorry?
Who did the assessment?
We are research assistants, graduate students. You guys. Yeah. Absolutely.
So my question is, how is that mediated, and how is the partnering different at the high school level?
Right, that's a good question. So at high school, we're typically in resource rooms, or we're in non-special ed but remedial rooms, where the kids, for the most part, are all, I mean, despite that they're, say, in 11th grade, they're all reading at about a third or fourth grade level.
Okay.
We also have data from what we call school improvement projects. There was a period of about 6 or 7 years when Lynn and I had a contract with the Title I office of the Nashville Public Schools, and they would pay us a certain amount of money a year, and we would take that money and we would train master students to provide technical assistance, specifically PALS reading and PALS math, in highest poverty Title I schools. Title I, the nature of Title I has changed over time. It used to be, 10, 15 years ago, a school could not qualify as Title I if they didn't have they were required to have a very high proportion of their kids on free or reduced lunch, like 80%, 80, 90%. Today, you can find, or I can show you, schools in the Metro Nashville school system that are quote-unquote Title I schools, and about 45% of kids are on free and reduced lunch. But when we were doing this so-called school improvement project work, we were working in very, very strongly impacted, low economic schools. And unlike the randomized control trials, we had less control over the way the PALS was implemented. We had much less data collection because we weren't resourced to do that. We didn't have the money to do that. Nevertheless, I want to share some data with you. This is slightly skewed, but this is a report card on Gower Elementary. Anyone doing work at Gower? Yeah. At Gower Elementary. Gower Elementary, about 15 years ago, had an extremely talented principal. And despite that, her school was not doing well in terms of, and there was a director of schools who was the first in, I think, ever, who started broadcasting school performance, school by school by school, and published it in the Tennessean. And so you were able to turn to page 11, you know, and see a rank ordering of all 66, 65 elementary schools by their performance on the Tennessee Comprehensive Assessment Program. and by grade, and not by teacher. And Gower was near the bottom. And this director of schools, in a highly publicized news conference downtown, highlighted the top five schools and the bottom five schools. And hers was one of the bottom five schools, and she was in the audience, and she was tremendously embarrassed and ashamed, and she called up the next day. She called me up the next day. I didn't know her. She called me up the next day, and she said that she wanted Lynn and me and others. Well, Lynn and I weren't the only ones, but she wanted us to help turn her school around, and she was crying. And so that started a 3 or 4 year partnership where we used monies, district monies, to train graduate students to be the technical assistance team in Gower and five other schools. And everyone used progress monitoring, known as curriculum-based measurement, to track children's progress. Every child in the school's progress was monitored weekly, and they used peer-assisted learning strategies in reading and math, and they did other things too for which we were not responsible. So I'm not taking full credit for this. But you see, 1993, the way to read this is 76, 74, and so forth. This is the value-added score on the TCAP, where 100 represents average progress. Average national progress. So any number below 100 means your school is progressing at a much slower, at a slower rate. Gower was progressing at a much slower rate. And then the number in the parentheses was the ranking of Gower at on each of these in each of these domains or subject areas out of 65 or 66 elementary schools. So that was 1993. The next year, you can see that they went from 76 to 108. 112, 91, and so forth, and their rank orderings shot up from 61st to 12th, and so forth. So the school was turned around very quickly. I always, parenthetically, one of the things that I'm very impatient with is the assertion, which I read often in the literature, that in order to get any meaningful change, a school change, you have to be patient and you have to wait 3 and 4 years. I think that's junk. That's just not true. From our experimental work and from our school improvement projects, we felt, and other people looking at our work felt, that PALS was an effective practice. It was an evidence-based practice. Okay? Well, what was the kind of assistance that we were providing? The kind of assistance we were providing in the, at the school level, we were training teachers. We were helping teachers, preparing them to be essentially the change agents in their classroom. They were the ones who trained their kids and monitored their performance and encouraged them and so forth and so on. But we had graduate students in there once or twice a week and to monitor how things were going, and so forth. And this went for the duration of our work. It could have been 16 or 20 weeks in an experimental study. It could have been longer for a school improvement project. So it begged the question, and this is an important question, can we scale a best evidence practice up? Do we know how, if we're interested in doing it, how do we do it? And that's a really important question, because my colleagues in special education are probably among the best, if not the best, as a group, interventionists in the country. We know how, over time, if you give us enough time and money, we'll figure out how to develop an effective academic program or an effective behavioral program. So I'm not trying to diminish that. That's important. But in PALS, you know, we did this work in Nashville. How successful? How do we get that thing to work in Chattanooga? How do we get it to work in Sioux City or in San Diego? We don't have a clue. We didn't have a clue. My colleagues and I didn't have a clue. And educational researchers generally, with a few exceptions, have done miserably in terms of scaling up best evidence practices. Okay, this is a major deal because we're spending, you know, collectively hundreds of millions of dollars a year trying to develop best evidence practices. And if they're only good in the, you know, 15,000 person town in which the thing was developed, then, you know, we're just not doing what we should be doing. So, IES, which is now the research arm of the U.S. Department of Education Institute on Education Sciences, has become increasingly interested in this question and has developed a series of grant mechanisms or programs that distinguish, rightly I think, between efficacy studies, which is what I've talked with you about. We're good at efficacy studies, whether the program can be effective, and effectiveness studies as opposed to efficacy studies refers to how does this program do at scale. So with grades 2 through 6 PALs in reading as a prop, it's not really a prop, but as a program, as a best evidence program, and student reading achievement as the criterion. The question that we asked after thinking about this long and hard was this, and there's a radical element to this question. Might a bottom-up approach to scaling up be more effective than top-down? Top-down is what my colleagues and I have always done. We develop the program, sometimes with help from teachers, but it's our program. And we then go to a school and we say, we have got a program for you, but you got to do it exactly the way we tell you how to do it. Okay? And so oftentimes, you know, you have superintendents of schools or directors of something or other, you know, in there with us, and they're saying, yes, and we want you, you know, we strongly encourage you to do this program, and you must do it the way that Fuchs tells you to do it. There's a logic for that. The logic is that we have data on PALs, in this case, PAL grade 2 through 6 PALs, when it was implemented in a very specific way. If you stray too far from how we did it, you might do better, but you might do worse. The point is, we don't know how you would do. Okay? So there is a logic for saying, look, let's proceed in a top-down manner. I know how to do it, you don't. I'll teach you how to do it, and you got to do it the way I'm telling you to do it if you want to get the kind of results we got. Okay? The problem with that is, and some of you are ahead of me on this, there are a lot of teachers, and I would venture to say a lot of very good teachers, who bridle at that. There is this implicit presumption, right? And some people go further, and people in the academy, there are a lot of people in the academy who do not like this top-down approach. They say it robs teachers of their professionalism, of their autonomy, of their responsibility to make their own decisions and so forth. And when you come in and you say that you know better than they, you know, where do you come off? Okay? So there's this very interesting tension between those who push a top-down approach and others who push a bottom-up approach. And you see it in education. You see it in other fields as well, top-down versus bottom-up. Top-down people tend to view teachers as technicians. Okay, that's not a derogatory term. And others view, you know, that as insulting and push for an alternative approach where they are professionals. And so in the literature, in the policy literature, in other educational literatures, there is this kind of, it seems as if there's a dichotomy. You know, you're either a top-down person or a bottom-up person. Okay? And I'm going to suggest to you that is a false dichotomy. These are not mutually exclusive categories. Okay? For this study, and this was a big study, we got a lot of money, and Peabody got a lot of money off of this effort. We all did. But we used it, I think, wisely. It was a multi-site randomized controlled trial for 5 years, and I'm talking with you about the last 3 years. It involved Vanderbilt University and Nashville and surrounding school districts. It involved the University of Minnesota and Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington schools, and it involved the University of Texas, Pan American, and six school districts in Hidalgo County, Texas, which I'm told are the six poorest school districts in the country. It's right on the border of Texas and Mexico. So what we did in developing this grant application was to say to the federal government and to the reviewers of the application, look, we have the site at which this best evidence practice was developed. We have a proximal site, a site that knows PALS, knows the brand name some, and the schools are very savvy, used to working with researchers from the University of Minnesota, but are not as knowledgeable about PALS as the teachers at this site. And then we have this distal site where research is rarely, conducted in the schools. Universities do not bring research or graduate students into the schools, and they know nothing about PALS at all. And so these were the three sites that we chose to test our capacity to scale up. So we had, we recruited teachers in two cohorts. They were all third, fourth, and fifth grade teachers. Cohort one entered, and they all had to agree to 2 years of participation. So in cohort one entered the study in 2006, 2007. Cohort two entered the following year. In the first year for each cohort, they learned how to do PALS in a top-down manner. Okay, you with me? In the second year, we said to them, you have the choice now of choosing to stay with top-down or to switch to bottom-up, and I'll tell you how we define bottom-up. We also had a control group. So I should say that in the first year, for each cohort, we had a bunch of teachers, and we, in the first year, randomly assigned all of the teachers. In 2006-07, we randomly assigned them to top-down or to controls. In the second year, the top-down teachers got to decide whether they were going to stay or become bottom-up. The controls stayed as controls. In 2007-2008, the process repeated. All of the new group of teachers were randomly assigned into top-down or control, and in their second year, they had the choice to change or not. So this gives you a rough sense. These numbers aren't exactly right, but this gives you a rough sense of the number of teachers in the second year of each cohort. So we had 42 teachers in the second year who remained top-down. We had 38 who were top-down to begin with but switched to bottom-up. And we had about 46 controls. We had about 140 teachers in this part of our work. And this is a rough approximation of the numbers of children. And so you see we have about 1,400 children involved in the study across the three sites. So again, in the first year of each cohort, we had, control teachers did what they would normally do. We didn't affect what they were normally doing. PALS teachers did PALS grades 2 through 6 in the first year, and partner reading, retell, paragraph shrinking, prediction relay. In year two, the teachers who chose bottom up implemented what we referred to as core components. For that second year, when teachers could choose bottom up, we work very hard to figure out what can we get rid of? What can we get rid of PALS? What do we really think is the essence of it, and what do we think is not the essence of it? And the part that we're willing to get rid of, that's the amount of time that we go to the teachers and say, in this time, we want you to fill up this time with activities that you feel are more responsive to your curricula, to your students, to the particulars of your professional situation. And we'll help you think about those things, if you want to. So we strongly encourage them to, in a sense, customize the rest of PALS. It had to adhere to, or it had to reflect, certain criteria. We didn't tell them, do whatever the hell you want to do. We created a large sandbox, if you will, or space. And we said, within this space, be creative. And do what you want, and we will help you. But don't go outside of this space. So for bottom-up PALS, their minimum number of sessions could be 48. The others, 54. The top-down was 54. 35 minutes a session stayed the same. They were required to do partner reading and paragraph shrinking, but not prediction relay and not several other things. So long story short, what we did here was we created about half, we reduced PALS within the 35-minute session. We reduced PALS by about half. We gave, and that's the amount of time that we said teachers could do what they wanted to do. These were our student measures. You may not be able to see them, but these were our reading measures, and they spanned reading at the word level and letter and word identification, reading fluency, and reading comprehension and vocabulary. Okay. Teacher measures. Lots of teacher measures that we took. For the 140 teachers, you can take a quick look at that. We worked with Mark Behrens, for those of you in LPL. So let me see whether I need to say anything here. So our pre-testing each year took place in September and October. We had a workshop for all teachers. The implementation was designed to last 18 weeks. During those 18 weeks, we had three booster sessions for top-down and bottom-up teachers where they all came together separately, and we talked with them, we worked with them on problems that they were having, and we post-tested in March through May. So, our results. I'm going to skip a lot of stuff here. All right, this is what I want to show you. So what we have here is, these are effect sizes expressed as standard deviation units. So this means half a standard deviation difference. Standard deviation in terms of group performance on a reading measure is a big deal. Okay. So the orange columns are overall low, average, and high achieving kids. So overall is the sum, or is the average. These are low achieving kids. These are average achieving kids. These are high achieving kids. Okay. BU is bottom up PALS. Doesn't look great. We've just recently, analyzed these data, so it's not real polished, doesn't look real good. But so bottom-up PALS versus controls is this comparison. Top-down versus controls is this comparison. Bottom-up PALS versus top-down PALS is this comparison. And PALS overall, remember, in the first year of each cohort, we randomly assigned teachers to either a PALS group or a no PALS group, and the PALS group was top-down. In the second year of each cohort, they split off into top-down and bottom-up. So, and this is missing an asterisk right here. So what we found was this. Bottom-up teachers' children significantly outperformed control teachers' children on a variety of meaningful reading measures. Top-down PALS teachers' children outperformed control teachers' children. Bottom-up PALS teachers' children outperformed top-down teachers' children. And PALS overall beat controls. And you can see by what standard deviation. So what we found was PALS beat controls. Well, we assumed that would be the case. The real question was, what was a better condition, top-down or bottom-up? Top-down, where teachers were driven, their PALS behavior was driven by a manual, a teacher manual, or bottom-up, where part of what they did for PALS was, in a sense, a continuation of top-down, but a big chunk of it was not. And it was that group of teachers that affected the greatest student achievement. Okay? So you understand what I'm saying, right? To me, that's very, very interesting, because that's not the way educational researchers. It's not the way a lot of educational researchers interested in program development do their work. And if program developers are interested in eventually having their work scaled up or adopted by other teachers in other places, I'm beginning to think these data suggest, they don't prove anything, but they suggest that those program developers will have a better shot at broader adoption if they deliberately build into their program flexibility, opportunity for teachers to customize. Not willy-nilly. I'm convinced it can't be willy-nilly. It's got to be with certain broad, within certain parameters. But doing it that way, I think will enhance adoption and make the program more valuable to more people. So, I come back to this top-down versus bottom-up debate, often a very bitter debate, and I think it really simplifies or ignores the possibilities for some kind of creative, flexible interaction or marriage combination of the two, top-down and bottom-up. Even I hesitate to say this because I don't want to, get in trouble. But even on this campus, there are departments and programs that adhere to one or the other, and I will only identify my department as a pretty top-down oriented department, and I think that the top-down people need to understand the importance of custom of professionalism and customizing and so forth. I do know that our perspective is we are as interested as any other academic department in helping people become professionals and all that that entails. But the way that we think about it is, to become a professional, you first need to know a lot of stuff, and you need to know how to do it, quote unquote, correctly. And others in other parts of Peabody, I'm sure, would disagree. But that's kind of like the strategy we took in this project, and I think it has potential. So I'm going to stop there and open it up to any questions or comments you may have. Yeah. The question is whether we compared, for a given teacher, the bottom-up performance to the top-down performance she did in the first year. It's a good question. We only collected data, by the way, in the second year. No, I'm sorry, that's not right. These data are from the second year. We collected data on first-year performances. And what I should tell you is there were no differences between top-down and bottom-up teachers in the first year that they were participating with. They had different kids in the first year than in the second year. So we can't easily go from year one to year two. But it was important for us to look at their year one performance because we wanted to rule out as an alternative explanation for the superiority of bottom-up that bottom-up teachers were just better teachers. And the data did not show that, at least in terms of reading, their kids' reading performance. So the answer to your question is no. Yeah?
I'm just wondering if between the three different sites, did you notice any significant differences?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. I didn't mention it. There were no significant differences. So what you see there is for all three sites. And and I thank you for asking, because that's really key. I mean, this is a scaling up study, and if we had found what we call an interaction between the effectiveness of treatment and site, then we would know that we didn't do it. This suggests we're on the right track.
Do you think we would have had different results if you had implemented a bottom-up strategy in the first year?
So the question is, what would we have done? What might have happened if we had implemented bottom-up first year? We thought about that, and what we decided, right or not, is everyone needed to know Hows before they could play it. And so, that's what we did. We felt like they would have they'd have a stronger ground or basis for playing once if they knew what it was. Yeah.
In the freedom that was given for the bottom up, did you see any trend that you asked them to sort of keep track of the different creative flexibility items they may put into that, and did you see any trending in that?
Good point. Good question. We did. We kept very careful track. We have very detailed logs on all the bottom-up teachers did. And a lot of what they did was, interestingly, fill out, if you will, the Hows approach. So we have no writing. Not because we don't think writing is important, but it's terrifically important, but we have 35 minutes a day. That's what we determined a long time ago. 35 minutes a day, 3 days a week. That's all we could expect of teachers. That's roughly 20% of a reading and language art required story. You try going into school and getting teachers to agree to do your program for 40%, forget it. So what did they do? Some of them chose a writing component, and they had it peer reading. Others used a spelling program and adapted it for class. Others did vocabulary and so forth. It's still, you could ask, and I would wonder, okay, so we know what they did, but it still doesn't explain why the bottom teacher did that. Now we had a focus group not long ago, just a few week or so ago, and a lot of bottom-up teachers. And so we showed data to them, and they were, of course, flattered. They thought it was terrific. They did the best. And so I said, so how come? How do you explain this? And this is anecdotal, who knows how much to start with it, but it was interesting. They were saying things that I'm sure you could guess. What do you think it is?
as to why they felt bottom-up could be tough.
Because they knew their students.
They knew their students, and they could adapt it to their students. What else? They had a stronger sense of agency. They were part of, you know, this program became their program. You know, it's first year, it was my program. Second year, it was their program. And they were invested. Now, is that true? I don't know if it's true. I mean, it sounds right, but I don't know. And even if they were invested, is that how does that translate into actual action and behavior? That would be really interesting. Yeah?
I just had a question about the components of the top-down program. Are the texts chosen as part of the program, or did teachers have choice in terms of text selection in terms of the top-down approach?
The second.
We don't
pick any texts. In fact, we've always encouraged teachers to use multiple texts so that you have, because during that time, remember I mentioned early on, I mentioned very briefly how it does represent a short period during the day where, because it's intermediated, instead of the teacher working with 26 as a group, she has 13 groups of two. And so you can do things. You can, even within top down, you can do things somewhat differently from one group to another group to another group. And so occasionally you'll have a group that's fairly high functioning in terms of reading, and another group that's fairly low functioning. Well, should they be in the same text? Are we moving on? Yeah?
Earlier in the series, we had heard a little bit about how policies support that affects the lower end students disproportionately, the upper end students for the achievement gap back to the close. Do you have any data as far as the effect size relative low end performers to high end performers?
Well, so the question is, do we have any data to suggest that the PALS program in this study or in other studies differentially affect low achieving kids so that maybe there would be a closing of the achievement gap? What's interesting here is, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I did not mention this, is that this is the low achieving group. And so you see here in this comparison, and also in this comparison, how the low achieving kids did better. But it's not the case that low achieving kids systematically did better across those comparisons. What we tend to get in our better experimental studies is a differential effect for treatment such that it accelerates the performance of the higher achieving kids, even though it's also accelerating the low-achieving kids in relation to controls. In other words, PALS promotes stronger reading and math performance among low-achieving kids in relation to their counterparts in non-PALS classrooms. But ironically, and this is very ironic for me, our initial purpose years ago was to shrink the heterogeneity, the range of academic performance in a classroom. We were hoping that we were going to find something to more greatly accelerate the bottom end of the distribution. Not forsaking the top end, but greater acceleration of the bottom end. We found the reverse. There's something called the fantail effect in educational research. And that's what we find. We demonstrate over and over again a fantail where instead of decreasing heterogeneity of academic performance, and this is not just true for PALS, it's true for many effective academic programs, and it's important for you to know. The more effective an academic program is, the greater the fantail, the greater the distribution, the wider the distribution becomes as a result of an effective treatment. You understand what I'm saying? We were trying to come up with academic programs that would be effective and practical for teachers and would reduce that heterogeneity. Because, as many of you know, I mean, the greater the heterogeneity in the classroom, the more difficult it is for a teacher to teach. The stronger the homogeneity, the easier it is, right? I mean, it's commonsensical and it's true. That's why small group tutoring, you can do a lot more, because you're working typically with a smaller and a much more homogeneous group of kids. And so effective programs really do the reverse. I think we're done.
Doug, thank you so much for, number one, capping off a terrific semester for us, but number two, I think giving us some things to think about that play across each of our programs, both in terms of implementation and adoption. But you all will have noticed that across the four speakers this semester, each one has touched in some way on the importance of design or measurement. And those are going to be things that continue to come back now and for those of you that continue your work in the future. So have a great break. There are some pastries and coffee on this cold day. You'll need to grab a cup to go. And we will see you in the spring.